2019 saw many important cases and issues that will shape False Claims Act enforcement today and in the years to come. In this podcast series, we'll analyze some key developments to help you be better prepared if the government comes calling with tough questions. In this episode, we'll visit with Hogan Lovell's partner, Mike Tice, and associate Clara Troyer, both from our Denver office, as they discuss the lessons from Polansky versus Executive Health Resources Incorporated.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Michael Tice, a partner in the Investigations, White Collar, and Fraud Practice Group at Hogan Lovell's in Denver, Colorado.
Hi, I'm Clara Troyer, an associate in the Litigation, Arbitration, and Employment Practice in the Denver office of Hogan Lovell's.
So, Clara, let's start with the basics of the Polansky decision. What was the factual background for the case?
Sure. So Dr. Polansky, the relator, alleged that Executive Health Resources, which performs certification reviews of inpatient admissions for hospitals, falsely designated admissions as inpatient when they should have been designated as outpatient.
Okay. And the implication of that is, as I understand it, is that the hospitals that were using these services would then get a higher amount of Medicare reimbursement for the inpatient admissions. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
So what were the rules that applied to the determination of inpatient or outpatient status during the relevant period of time?
So there's two relevant periods of time. First, before October 1st, 2013, the determination of inpatient status had been the subject of multiple guidance documents published by CMS. And these were Medicare hospital manuals that were issued by the agency, but didn't go through formal notice and comment. And then after October 1st, 2013, the determination of inpatient status was governed by something called the two midnight rule. And that rule was to admit an individual as inpatient, the admitting physician had to conclude that he expects the patient's stay will cross two midnights. And the two midnight rule was promulgated through notice and comment and codified in the Code of Federal Regulations at 42 CFR section 412.3D1.
And the relator alleged that the defendants had caused hospitals to misapply these rules and falsely certify patients as inpatients instead of outpatients. And notwithstanding those allegations, the government declined to intervene in the case. And Dr. Polansky decided to proceed with the case as the quietam provisions of the False Claims Act allow. So he takes the case forward on his own, alleging thousands and thousands of false claims to Medicare and huge losses to the program. How did the court attempt to deal with the scope of the case from a procedural standpoint?
Like you said, there were a lot of claims that they were dealing with. And so the relators, the defendants, and the court all agreed upon a bellwether plan for discovery and for trial. They agreed upon a painstaking process for choosing the bellwether claims. For pretrial management, the case was divided into two segments or two phases. Phase one would deal with the claims for reimbursement before October 1st, 2013, and then phase two would deal with the two midnight rule claims, so the ones after October 1st, 2013.
So what happened to the case from a procedural standpoint? What happened next?
So a couple of things happened. First, Dr. Polansky belatedly revealed that he had a DVD in his possession that contained approximately 14,000 documents, some of which were relevant and had not been disclosed in discovery. And then also, Dr. Polansky unilaterally tried to change the method for the selection of claims without seeking court approval. Well, the court was not very happy with this. And so the defendants actually filed sanctions motions. And while that was pending, the government notified Dr. Polansky and the defendants that it intended to dismiss the case under subsection 3730C2A of the False Claims Act. So the parties entered into negotiations under which the government agreed not to dismiss, provided that the relator would proceed on significantly narrowed set of claims. But then the relator filed another amended complaint that diverged from what the government and the relator had agreed to do in narrowing the case.
And the government agrees to back off on filing the motion under section 3730C2A based on this agreement that the government believes that it has reached with the relator about narrowing the scope of the case. Is that right?
Right. That's correct. But then the relator diverged from that agreement.
Okay, so the relator files this third amended complaint, I think it was, that seems to just be proceeding on the expansive track that the relator had previously set forth on. Mm-hmm. And what happens then?
So then the government did file a motion to dismiss under subsection 3730C2A. The court held a hearing and on its own motion invited the parties under Rule 56F to address the Supreme Court decisions in the line of health services.
So a big part of the decision actually deals with the government's motion under subsection 3730C2A of the False Claims Act. What are the key takeaways on that part of the decision?
So the legal issue for that part of the decision is the appropriate standard of review for a motion by the government under 3730C2A. And federal courts have adopted two tests for this review. And the first is a rational relationship test, which is used by the Ninth and the Tenth Circuits, and then an unfettered discretion test used by the D.C. Circuit. The Plansky Court concluded that the government satisfied the more rigorous rational relationship test by showing that the preservation of litigation resources was rationally related to the dismissal, and then the relator failed to rebut that showing. So I think the key takeaway is that the burden for the government on a motion under 3730C2A is relatively modest, and the defendant should consider requesting a government motion to dismiss in declined cases where the Granston memo factors can be invoked.
Okay, interesting. So what about the impact of the Supreme Court opinions on the other components of this decision on summary judgment? How did the Polanski Court address or deal with the impact of, let's start with the Allina decision. What did the court have to say about that?
So under the Supreme Court decision in Allina, CMS must provide the public with advance notice and an opportunity to comment before adopting a rule, requirement, or any statement of policy that establishes or changes a substantive legal standard. And a substantive legal standard, according to the Supreme Court, is something that creates, defines, or regulates the rights, duties, and powers of parties. So policies that dictate or define Medicare coverage and reimbursement are, by definition, substantive legal standards because they define the provider's right to claim payment from the Medicare program.
Okay. So for purposes of this analysis, it sounds like this concept of what is a substantive legal standard is important. And how did the Polanski Court apply that part of the Allina decision to this agency sub-regulatory guidance that dictated the circumstances under which someone would be treated as an inpatient or an outpatient?
So the court concluded that the three manual provisions published before October 1st, 2013, which was part of the phase one claims, set coverage policy for Medicare hospital inpatient status, but without going through notice and comment. And because these guidelines delineated the circumstances in which a hospital is entitled to higher reimbursement, they affected the hospital's right to payment and were therefore a substantive legal standard. Because they did not go through formal notice and comment, they then cannot be given the force and effect of law.
Okay, so a substantive legal standard, according to the Supreme Court, is something that creates, defines, or regulates rights, duties, and powers. And there's no right that is more central to participation in the Medicare program than the right to be reimbursed for services that you provide, right? And so something that dictates coverage or the right to reimbursement is going to be a substantive legal standard, according to the Supreme Court in Allina and the Polanski Court here. So then how about the court's ruling on the two Midnight Rule claims, the claims from after October 1st of 2013? The two Midnight Rule, as you said earlier, was in fact promulgated through the formal notice and comment process. So there's no problem there under Allina in terms of enforceability of the reimbursement standard or the coverage provision.
Right. So this part of the decision concerned whether or not those claims were material under the Supreme Court's ruling in Escobar. And the court concluded that there were three factors that tended to show that the claims were not material. The first one was that there was no evidence that CMS ever refused payment on any of these claims, despite knowledge of how the defendants were applying the inpatient admission standards. The second factor is that the government declined to intervene in the Quitom suit. And then thirdly, the government moved to dismiss the suit under 3730C2A. So all of these three factors taken together, the court concluded, tended to show a lack of materiality.
So despite knowledge of this alleged fraudulent scheme and a two-year investigation of these claims, the government never denied any payment to the defendants, and that tended to undermine any assertion that the claims were materially false.
So I'm curious to hear what your impressions are of Polanski as an expert in these type of disputes. Specifically, how do you think the treatment of Allina will impact False Claims Act litigation in the future?
I think that this is an important decision for a couple of reasons. This Allina decision from the Supreme Court, I think, is going to continue to get a lot of attention in False Claims Act cases alleging Medicare fraud, alleging some sort of a fraud on the Medicare program. And the reason for that is that the holding in Allina depends upon a specific provision in the Social Security Act that you know, dictates the rules for Medicare that requires public notice and comment before CMS adopts any rule, requirement, or other statement of policy that establishes or changes a substantive legal standard, as we've talked about. This requirement in the Social Security Act is codified at 42 U.S.C. section 1395 HHA2. But the important point here is that there are many, many False Claims Act cases in which the government or a quitom relator are seeking to impose False Claims Act liability based upon the application of or interpretation of a coverage rule that is found only in agency sub-regulatory guidance. And I think that that offers defendants an opportunity to seek dismissal or seek summary judgment where the substantive legal standard, the Medicare coverage provision, has not gone through formal notice and comment.
Okay, interesting. And then what are your impressions about Escobar materiality and how this Polanski decision on materiality will impact future litigation?
What I think is interesting about the Polanski decision and its treatment of the Escobar materiality requirement is how that actually dovetails with the Allina ruling. And here's what I mean. Under Allina, a substantive legal standard must go through notice and comment in order to be given force and effect. Anything that dictates Medicare coverage, that is to say, anything that is addressing payment or reimbursement, is going to be a substantive legal standard. Now, under Escobar, materiality turns on whether the government would deny payment if it knew of the misrepresentation or omission. So, unless the defendant fails to comply with the standard that determines the defendant's right to payment, the requirement is likely not material under Escobar. In order to be material under Escobar, it has to govern the right to payment. But if it does, then under Allina, it has to have gone through the formal notice and comment process.
Okay, interesting. So do you see this holding in Polanski as being helpful for defendants in quitom suits?
I do. I think that this whole question of how the Supreme Court's analysis in Allina is going to be applied in other False Claims Act cases involving allegations of fraud on the Medicare program, I think that that is going to continue to be an important development. There are many, many False Claims Act cases alleging fraud on the Medicare program that, to some extent, depend upon agency sub-regulatory guidance documents for the proposition that the case involves fraud or false claims or material misrepresentations of some kind. And I think that these agency sub-regulatory guidance are going to get a lot closer scrutiny in these cases. I think that this also has to be considered in context with a Department of Justice memorandum published by then Associate Attorney General Rachel Brand in 2018, in which she stated that the department should not be relying upon agency sub-regulatory guidance for enforcement actions. And I would also note that The Office of General Counsel for the Department of Health and Human Services has also sent a memorandum on October 31st of 2019. The Office of General Counsel for HHS sent a memo to CMS outlining the impact of ELINA on Medicare payment rules. And in that memo, the Office of General Counsel expressly stated that to the extent that internet-only manuals or similar guidance documents set forth payment rules that are not closely tied to regulatory or statutory standards, that the government generally can't use violations of that guidance in enforcement actions. The memorandum that the Office of General Counsel sent expressly states that the critical question is whether the enforcement action could be brought absent the guidance document. And if the answer is no, then the guidance document establishes a norm, and under ELINA, it's invalid unless it was issued through the formal notice and comment rulemaking process. I think there is another aspect of this that is interesting, and I see this decision extending a thread that has been developing in a number of district court decisions, where the court has considered the government's failure to deny payment or the government's decision to decline to intervene as relevant to the materiality analysis under Escobar. This is something the Department of Justice has fought. You know, the department has long taken the position that its decision to decline to intervene in a case should not be viewed in any way as a comment on the merits of the case. But courts have increasingly been looking to the declination decision as having some bearing on whether or not the case involves materially false claims. And I think that that's a trend that's going to continue.
Very interesting. Okay, so what other trends or other things should we be looking out for in future cases?
Well, one thing I think the defendants should be focused on is whether the ELINA and Escobar decisions present an opportunity for defendants to seek government motions to dismiss under Section 3730C2A of the False Claims Act. As you pointed out, Clara, both the relator and the government objected to, strenuously objected, as you noted, to having the court consider the ELINA and Escobar decisions on a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment in Polanski. And I think that the reason that the Department of Justice objected to the Rule 56 consideration is that it may have been concerned about the risk that, you know, the court would, in fact, create adverse precedent on this whole question of the enforceability of agency subregulatory guidance, or adverse precedent for the Department of Justice on this question of materiality. And, you know, one of the things that the Department of Justice may have been doing in filing a 3730C2A motion to begin with was avoiding bad precedent under ELINA or under Escobar. And as it turns out, they, you know, they were unable to avoid that result. And the decision obviously addresses, and in a way that is not particularly helpful to the Department of Justice, addresses both agency subregulatory guidance and its enforceability in False Claims Act cases and materiality of misrepresentations or omissions in False Claims Act cases. So the very result that the government may have sought to avoid by filing a motion to dismiss under 3730C2A came about anyways.
Okay, well, thank you, Mike. I thought that was a fascinating discussion, and I appreciate your insight.
Thanks, Clara, for your participation. This concludes our podcast.
Thanks for joining us today. For additional analysis on this topic and others around the False Claims Act, please download our latest publication, FCA Guide 2019 and the Road Ahead, from HoganLevels.com.